They are a simple mouse click, and your responses will be left anonymous. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to John Firth, President and CEO of AMCS, who will get us started today. John?
Thank you, Sally. As Sally said, I'm the President and CEO of AMCS. If we would to turn to the next page, that would be helpful. AMCF is the trade association for the management consulting industry. We represent the breadth and diversity of practice within this industry. We are the vehicle for management consulting firms to come together and speak with a collective voice. We promote knowledge exchange, professional standards for the community of management consulting firms around the world. For our mission is to promote an environment which fosters the success of management consulting firms worldwide and the value delivered to clients. This webinar today is part of a university program we launched about a year and a half ago. We call it the Consulting Career Connection, which is an information hub and forum to learn and interact and collaborate. This is meant to fulfill the needs of students interested in pursuing a career in management consulting. Therefore, our objective is to build awareness of the industry as a great career choice, and we also promote the value proposition of management consulting as an industry. So in addition to these webinars, we have a wonderful website called consultingcareerconnection.com, which you can see here. It is a community-based platform, and here is a web shot, and we invite all of you to come there and to blog and to interact and to learn from your peers and from experts. So we'll move on to the agenda. So in a moment, I'll introduce you to our speakers, Carl Smith and Hank Harris. We're very pleased to have them with us. And now we're going to address really four topics. A lot of questions come up when I talk to students about just what sort of candidates do consulting companies look for. And without preempting it, I would say all kinds, and especially career changers, which I think we should address very quickly as part of this conversation. We're going to then talk to you about the recruitment process. Many of you have started that already. We'll give you some helpful hints. And then we'll also talk about the two most important aspects of that, which is the behavioral, or what some people call the fit interview, as well as the case interview. So, but before we get started, I'd like to get a little better sense of who's on the phone call. I have some polling questions. So our first one is, have you ever worked in management consulting before? Yes, no, or perhaps as an intern? And if you would answer that, and we can move to the results, we'll get a better sense of who's on the call. Okay, not unexpectedly, we see that the bulk of those on our survey here have not worked in consulting before, so we'll hope to give you a good sense of that in the next 60 minutes. Let's move to the next question. And here we just want to know where you're currently based, so we get a sense of where everybody is located. And if you would check on that and submit. Okay, interesting enough, not unexpectedly, a lot of you are in the Northeast, but we have a good contingent from the Midwest and actually quite a number outside of the USA. So that's good for us to know. We know many of the important academic institutions outside of the New York-Boston corridor here. So let's move on to the next question. So what level of education have you most recently completed or are in the process of completing? And again, just click on one and hit submit. And we see that we have a large contingent of undergraduate, but likewise quite a lot of graduate and master's students and a number of PhDs. So we will again try to address the undergraduates as well as the graduates and masters, and indeed a number of consulting firms do heavy recruitment of undergraduates, especially the Big Four and a lot of the HR consulting firms. And let's move to the next question. What is or was your major or concentration? And this will get to our first point that we're going to address in a second, which is who goes into consulting. And traditionally, of course, all the big firms have recruited at major MBA programs. But I'm glad to see here that we have a lot of liberal arts students. I myself have an undergraduate liberal arts degree. And of course, engineering, IT, technology are important places to for our firms to go recruit. As is very science-oriented, but also not represented here, but medicine and law are also favorite places to go. Anywhere where somebody is enjoying a good education and for a professional career. And let's go to the final question in this round. Which group best describes you? Again, please submit. So not unexpectedly, we, of course, have a lot of students, but I'm glad to see we have a number of career counselors who help those students make decisions, as well as a number of active consultants who I assume are interested in finding out more about how they can guide their career and so forth. So with that, let's get started with the content of this webinar. As I said, we'd like to introduce ourselves, so why don't I hand this over now to Hank and Carl for you to introduce yourselves.
Go ahead, Hank.
Are you on the phone? Or Carl?
I can start.
Okay,
well,
Carl.
Well, I'm Carl Smith with Ernst & Young. I'm the America's Advisory People Leader. And a little background on myself, over 20 years in consulting. I started originally in industry, and my consulting career has been both in the U.S. and internationally where I've worked and lived. And my focus has been on performance improvement and mergers and acquisitions. In my current role, I'm responsible for recruiting, learning and development, staffing of talent, and all HR matters, partners through staff. To give you a little context on Ernst & Young, the advisory practice, in 2002, I was the first consulting partner that the firm hired to begin rebuilding its advisory practice. And we are now, at a global level, 25,000 professionals, about $4 billion in revenues. And at the Americas level, which I have accountability for, 9,500 professionals and $2 billion in revenues. And that breaks down a combination of performance improvement services, which would include finance, supply chain, customer, people and org change, IT advisory is a long list, and then also our risk services that deal with internal audit, internal controls, also IT controls and IT security, which is also very hot within the market. So we're having great success in the market. We're growing at about 20% overall, and in our performance improvement practice, just shy of 30%.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, no, Ernst & Young is one of the big bright spots in the consulting universe right now, both for growth but also the quality of the work it does. Hank, I believe you're on the phone now. If you'd like to introduce yourself, FMI is now a smaller firm, very focused, and perhaps you can say a few words.
Well, first question, John, can you hear me?
Maybe you can get closer to the phone. I think you may be on speaker. It's a little soft.
John, is that any better?
That's excellent. Thank you, Hank.
Okay. Sorry, we're having some technical problems on my end, but I'm glad to be here. My name is Hank Harris. I'm the CEO of FMI Corporation, and we are a relatively small firm and compared to the certainly to Ernst & Young and the large consultancies, but we're an industry specialty firm. We focus on the construction industry or the built environment, and anybody that's in the value chain of that environment is really our focus. About 150 people and four offices, Raleigh, Denver, Tampa, and Phoenix. mostly work domestically, but we do a little bit of international work, and that's us in a nutshell.
Excellent. And I don't want to put you guys on the spot with a question, but I just got off the phone with a reporter who was asking me what is the number of recruits in total that we need to bring in the industry every year? And without getting specific numbers, I said I felt the industry had to refresh its ranks by between 10 and 15% every year. That's new people into the industry or return into the industry. Does that sound about right? I don't know, Carl, do you guys keep any kind of statistics?
We don't, but that seems a reasonable number. I know in the Americas, we're hiring about 100 partners and executive directors a year, and 2,000 experienced hires, which are seniors and above. And campus, we're hiring about 1,000 a year. That's just in the Americas.
Right. And given your current state, that's almost 30%.
Right, right. And our voluntary attrition, people leaving to seek other opportunities, be in industry or with a competitor, is only around 17%, which is well below industry standards, which is in excess of 20%. So don't have exact answer to your question as to how much we replenish, but we're making major investments to build the business in particular,
excellent,
probably a little bit more than some of our competitors are right now.
Yeah, I would definitely say that's at the top of the list of at least the information I have. Hank, any insights from yourself?
John, I think our turnover, because we're a small firm and because of the way our business model works, we're actually low turnover, and we want it that way. Our turnover is typically 7 or 8%, something like that. I just talked to a regional CPA firm yesterday about their turnover, and he said it was running probably 12 to 15, which is substantially down from what it used to be. And
right.
So I think the rates are lower, but you certainly got to at least hire for attrition
exactly,
at a minimum. And if you've got growth objectives over that, then that's going to influence that number.
And at about a $300 billion industry worldwide, which U.S. makes up about half of it, I come out with about 3 million employees of consulting firms. So we're talking about 500,000 a year, probably 400 to 500,000 a year worldwide that we have to attract and hire into the industry. So it's quite a lot of people, and we obviously are always looking for the most talented, the best, and the brightest, which brings us to our first topic.
And I think, John, as you look
just
big picture, the consulting industry, we have seen very strong growth in all sectors and in all competencies or capabilities. So it continues to be a very attractive place for talent to build a career and to further their career. And even after the downturn in the economy going back to 2008-2009, we've actually seen a bit of an uptick of firms interested in hiring consultants to impact their business, be it on the revenue side or the cost side or just the strategic side as well.
Exactly, and I often go to universities to be part of panels or to present the industry, and we get overwhelming response and interested parties, which is great. And I think people recognize that this is a great industry to make a career, to learn, to grow, both as business people, but also as human beings. So let's go to the first topic, which is just what kind of candidates consulting firms are looking for. And as I said, we talked to a lot of people, and we even did a study about a year and a half ago, if we can move to that slide, that asked the question, just what kind of people do consulting companies look to hire? And this is very much school-focused, i.e. Mostly MBA schools responded to this, and it was very overwhelming, the response of a very broad range, diverse, but also, second, cool and creative. A little counterintuitive, especially for people who haven't been in the industry. I would also like to add to this before I hand it over to Carl and to Hank to discuss that a lot of questions come up about changing careers. This is an industry that is open to a diverse number of backgrounds. I don't know how many people have given me the example of the ballet dancer who went back to do his or her MBA program. and then went into consulting and was very happy and did great things. I would just say that I actually have a music degree undergrad, so I'm not too far away, although I don't think I could dance a ballet if my life depended on it. But again, we're looking for a huge diverse group of backgrounds. Obviously, there are key skill sets that Hank and Carl will talk about. Well, with this, I would ask perhaps Hank, you could get started to say how do you react to this study, to these results, and what are you looking for when you recruit?
John, I think the study is pretty good, and it certainly covers, you know, the waterfront. It makes sense to me that it would be diverse in terms of what people are looking for. I think in terms of FMI and what we look for, some of the things, I think McKinsey got credit 20 years ago for coming up with the acronym SWAN. If you remember, the SWAN stood for smart, work hard, ambitious, and are nice. And that's a nice little package to keep in mind if you're going to be in consulting, because it takes all four of those dimensions. And, you know, they can seem a little bit, counterbalancing perhaps when you think about people that are really willing to work very hard, be very ambitious and driven, but they're also nice people. And you know, sometimes those things don't come in one package, but that's very much what we look for. We have to have people that are analytically bright, but if they can't communicate effectively, to others, whether those others are their clients or their colleagues, they're not going to succeed in what we do. And so being a communicator and being a genuinely good person, in addition to, you know, having a reasonable amount of ambition, is important.
And another thing to you, Hank, specifically, is because you are a very focused firm on engineering construction in particular, what is the sort of background in terms of skill set, but also industry? This question comes up a lot. I think a lot of people are concerned, especially if they're career changers, of just what is their background experience in the workplace? How important is that, and what do you look for?
You know, in our firm, because we want people to actually do it for a career and become professionals at what we do and sink their teeth into it, we typically do not hire many people right out of college, undergrad, you know, with the exception of we do have some interns that we do every once in a while. But for the most part, we want somebody who's lived a little bit and has gone back to school and gotten an MBA. It's convenient if they've done something that happens to, you know, have a background in our industry, that works well too. But we do not hire many undergraduates. It's mostly MBAs, and it's mostly MBAs that have probably lived life a little bit in their, you know, couple of three jobs perhaps, so that they've seen the world a little bit. And those tend to be the people that want to do what we do.
Excellent. Now, Carl, for such a big firm, we've already gotten a good feel for just how many people you are looking to hire this year. How does a big firm like Ernst & Young, a global firm, think about this question?
Yes, a very similar thoughts to it was already covered. One thing would be very strong problem-solving and analytical skills that we're looking for at all levels. From the entry level on up, because in the consulting business, everything is gray. There's not a recipe to what we do. So you have to have good ability to think on your feet, good ability to solve complex problems and hypothesize, to work through to solutions. The analytical part is extremely important for us. The clients are making decisions based off our recommendations. And if they're just theoretical, or if they're just academic, if you will, in nature, that is not very helpful. So the analytical part, which is based upon understanding how the math works and how a company runs, is extremely important. As John mentioned earlier, the communication and interpersonal skills are very important. You have to have strong verbal and written skills. Actually, we do a required written assessment of a writing sample, and what's behind that is our work products that we provide our clients do require not just spreadsheets but also a write-up, and we have to really make sure people can communicate effectively both written and verbal. The interpersonal skills, we put a lot of weight on that because all levels, staff hire, that's undergraduate level hire, all the way up, are in front of clients. We really don't run a business. We keep our people in the back office, so to speak. I know some firms do, but we've opted, larger firms do, but we've opted not to do that. I'd say finally, strong work ethic. You have to really have a passion. I'm sure John could comment on this as well. You have to have a passion for this business. There are a lot of long hours that are involved. There are a lot of travel, at least in our business, that's involved. So you really have to have a commitment to take on these complex business challenges, which also finally ends up with flexibility. There has to be a good degree of flexibility when you sign up for a career in consulting.
You use that magic word right now, Carl, career. And so the third point on here, and I've touched on it a couple of times, is the question of career changers. This question comes up a lot from students is, what does it look like either if you go to school and clearly want to change your career, myself being a perfect example, but also if you're in mid-career and are saying, look, you know, I think consulting will offer me more of what I'm looking for, whether it's variation in work or a chance to see the world or on multiple industries or projects. What's the Ernst & Young view of career changers in consulting?
Well, I'm a career changer. I started my degrees in psychology. I actually practiced for a couple of years earlier in my life cycle. And then I went into industry. I went into mergers and acquisitions, actually, kind of a real right-hand turn in my career path. And then I was a vice president of a financial services firm, and then I opted to join a consulting business. I actually joined as a senior consultant, very similar to levels of MBA would be joining at. So I took a huge step backwards in my career to advance my career. So if you're looking at career changes, sometimes you have to go backwards to go forwards in your career, but then you have all that foundation to work on as you look moving forward. So there's a lot of, again, it's the academic part is important, the good grades, the certain courses that you would have taken depending upon the competency that you're going to focus in on. But there is some flexibility in people that have made career changes. Now, you have to kind of make up for that in life experiences. Hank mentioned it earlier. In this business, if you don't have the necessarily the technical courses that you've taken in your career, but then you've had work experiences, life experiences that have helped develop some of those competencies or capabilities and or sector knowledge, then you could be valuable to a consulting firm. Perfect situation is you have both. But if you're making a career change, a lot's going to depend upon your work experience that you're bringing to the table.
Yeah.
Would you concur then as well, Hank? Sorry.
Well, I was going to add to that. It's a slightly different twist, but in our industry, because it's privately held business for the most part, it's very different than what you read about with, you know, public companies. And, you know, of course, the, you know, guys like the McKinsey guys are famous for becoming, you know, famous executives and do very well in that regard. But in our industry, I notice that former executives, generally speaking, make lousy consultants. And some of my best consultants really make lousy executives. It is a very different skill set.
Right.
I would agree. I would really. And you kind of have to follow your DNA, I think, Hank.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I myself have done anything. Actually, I didn't realize this, Carl, but you and I have almost exact parallel paths.
That
I started with music, but went to M&A as well, worked for Deutsche Bank, and then ended up in consulting. So very similar. But I think that's a point well taken, is that I think many people at many points in the career, obviously it's earlier, that's easier to make these career changes.
Yes.
But there's so much life experience and skill sets that go into being a successful consultant. The secret really becomes to find the right kind of firm that you can be successful at, and that's what we tell our students. And that's why we're so happy to have both a small boutique firm like FMI represented and then one of the larger companies, Ernst & Young. So let's move on to the next question, because this is where a lot of students begin to – oh, we'll first ask Sally, are there any questions that have come from the audience for this section? Sally? Is Sally on the phone?
I think there might have been one, John, as to on the slide that talks about the survey that was done. What was the sampling of the schools? I think that was one of the questions I saw pop by.
Okay. This survey was done of top MBA schools simply because we decided to do the survey around the schools that have the most exposure to consulting traditionally and have the most sophisticated recruitment preparation. If I were to do this with schools, medical schools, or law schools that don't tend to have that much exposure to the consulting industry, I would suspect that it wouldn't be that much different. And as I said, I talk to a number of schools every week. I was just recently at NYU Polytech. You find that very often it's the same responses.
Yeah.
Any more questions that have come up?
There was another one here, and I can answer it. And Hank may want to jump in too. I have to go back up. It's already bumped. Is there a age cutoff when you are no longer interested in career changers? My response to that is no. And what's behind that? I'll give you a great example. When I mentioned we hire about 100 plus partners and executive directors a year for the last couple of years at Ernst & Young, the executive director role, which is more of that subject matter expert, extremely knowledgeable. In many cases, those are executives in business that have really got huge brand recognition in a particular industry or particular discipline. It could be regulatory in nature. They become very much in demand later in their careers, and they want to make a shift out of industry. And they could be well into their 50s at that particular point in time. But they're bringing an awful lot of work and brand in the market experience, because it does equate to sales when it's all said and done. Can they impact our sales agenda or not? Because we don't hire typically luminaries, people that will just float around and sprinkle dust and ideas on things. We really have to find people that can impact our growth agenda and that can really develop our people. So that's on one end of the far end of the continuum. But typically people make career changes in their 20s and 30s. We see a lot of that.
Yeah, Carl, just to add to what you're saying, I would totally agree with you. I don't think that age is an issue. It's all about whether the person has good consultative skills. And in our world, good consultative skills require empathy, and they require the ability to listen, and they require the ability to synthesize many different scenarios and benchmarks and help craft a solution for the client, drawing from a lot of different experiences, drawing from a lot of different data and analyses and what have you, to be able to synthesize all that. I think our clients don't want somebody that's just going to tell them what to do or tell them from one dimension.
Absolutely.
And so it's all in the skill sets of the individual. And if the individual has those skill sets when they're 25 or 85, then they'll be good consultants.
Yeah, Hank, you said that very well. I mean, some firms have a tendency to like to tell clients what to do. So it's like to fish for them, so to speak, to use that analogy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more successful firms and the firms with more longevity are really help the clients learn how to fish. They really team with the clients. They really are active listeners with the clients. And they really care about the client's business. But they have to bring something to the table. They have to bring some content. They have to bring some knowledge. They have to bring an ability to help move the needle for the client's business, or otherwise they're just an empty suit.
Yep, exactly.
Exactly. Well, good. I think that hinges now on the next section, which is the recruitment process, because, of course, a young person in particular, but also those mid-career, need to be able to show what they can do. And you as heads of firms and point persons for some of the big recruiting that goes on have to be able to find a way to test skill set, understand what the individual is bringing to the table so that you can make an informed decision about hiring that person or not. And that's why we do have a very sophisticated, if I can use that word, system that is considered somewhat industry standard, but of course is adapted by firms to their own needs. So let's go to the next page where we really talk about the overarching recruitment process. And it's fairly generic. It shouldn't be really any huge news to anybody, but I just want to kick this discussion off by saying, look, you know, many people, if you're at school, will have an Office of Career Recruitment or Career Services where, you know, they have everything in place for you to submit your resume, get it all fixed up, put in a book, or sent off to potential but those of you who are at schools and colleges and so forth that don't have such a developed career office are going to find that you're going to have to apply online or send off a CV and covering letter and be part of a big group of people who are applying to get in the industry. And for the most part, I hope that system works so that at some point you get invited to a behavioral interview, or some people call it an assessment center interview. That's usually the first one. Again, this is sort of a generic overview. And then you go into the case interview. Now, as the behavioral interview, you can't really prepare for because you have to be who you are. The case interview does require quite a bit of preparation. We'll talk about that in a second. That goes on to often some sort of a partner interview and then the final offer. So, as I said, within this, there are very much variations, but maybe, Carl, you want to talk a little bit about how it looks at Ernst & Young.
Oh, absolutely. So that first group, you're right, absolutely, the campus, applying on campus is critical. We at Ernst & Young have a targeted campus approach where there are priority schools where we spend extra time in. But we do hire from many, many different schools, undergraduate and MBA. And then obviously, if we're not at that school, people can apply online through ey.com, the career page. And that's pretty standard out there for any firm. The behavioral interview, we will spend a good bit of time really understanding the person's educational work experience and culture fit. We actually spend an awful lot of time, even early on, understanding, will they fit in? Will they fit into our cultural, our culture, into our values? Teaming is a very important a premium we place on that, and there's other values, obviously, within the firm. We also do a writing sample, as I mentioned earlier. So there is a writing sample. It's actually done online nowadays. It used to be done where we'd have all these laptops and people would come in and they'd have to, in a half an hour's time, produce a written work product. The case interviews, and I know we'll talk about that a little bit later on, so I'll save those comments for later if you like, but the approach we've taken is more of a real-world case interview, not a hypothetical situation. And then the final partner interview, it is a lot about what I call strategic fit. What's the individual's short-term impact to our business needs? So, yes, we hire a lot of people, but we don't have an infinite number of hires that we're going to make every year, from interns to full-time hires. It is a very selective, it is a very high bar to clear, and we have to hit our numbers, but we also can't hire anybody. There's also long-term fit. That's kind of where you kind of project out how that person can play in this business long term. Do they have the passion for continuous learning? Do they have the strong work ethic and flexibility? And then I mentioned the culture fit. We come back to that even at the very end for kind of a last pulse check. Are they going to fit into our culture and really embrace our values? And then the offer stage, some firms have the partners make the offers, firms have the recruiters make the offers. It does vary on that. But they're pretty straightforward. We bring in the staff at roughly the same and the MBA folks at roughly the same. There isn't a lot of variety in that. Further up you get in the organization, there is a lot more ranges that you're dealing with, compensation ranges, as you progress in your career. Hank, I don't know. As you look at the continuum here, any additional thoughts?
I think, Carl, that our process is very similar to yours, even though we're much much tinier. It's probably a little bit less structured, perhaps, but we pretty much go through those same exact steps. The only thing I would add is that we're big believers in the behavior, and we do a lot of behavioral testing and looking at that, and you know, it's kind of like I think you and I talked about before, is if somebody can be really, really smart, but if they don't have the, you know, the temerity to go toe-to-toe with the CEO and tell them what they really think and engage at that C-suite level, they will not succeed in our business.
Absolutely.
So that persona is really, really important in our world.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
and one of the things
nice.
That we've done, which I'd like to see us revisit, I know it takes extra cycles, that's why we kind of put a pause on it. We used to have the campus recruits break up into small teams, and they'd have to solve a problem together. And we would actually observe how they interact with each other. Is there good teaming, or is there somebody just taking all the toys and saying, I'm the leader type of a thing? That's very a good character-revealing exercise, but it's a big time commitment. That's why we haven't been doing that lately. But I know some firms still do that.
And I think this is unless there's some questions, and I think we've realized now that unfortunately Sally has been cut off. We can't seem to solve the problem. But Carl, if you need any of the questions, anything that came up in the section?
Yeah, the one that came up relative to this topic is, can we get examples of the type of behavioral tests that are done? Hank, did you care to comment on that?
Sure. There are what I would call surface-level behavioral tests that are out there. There are a lot of them. Most firms will use those to get, you know, what I would call as kind of a screener, just to see, you know, if there's a general fit at the surface level. Some examples are, we've forever used something called the DISC profile.
Oh, sure.
D-I-S-C.
Yeah.
Myers-Briggs, which is a famous tool that's been used, you know, forever by a lot of firms. There's an instrument we're now using called ProScan, which is another, you know, again, sort of surface level type fit thing. Carl, I think somebody with your background would know more than I would about, you know, some of these other things like FireOB. I remember, mm-hmm. I can't remember what it's supposed to tell you, but I remember that it's out there. And then we've actually had an industrial psychologist who has done some custom stuff on a more in-depth level once we've gotten down to the final strokes on a significant hire. But that's at a more in-depth – that's not something you could just go out and find on the market.
No. And I think, Hank, if it may be done either formally – like some of the tests that you mentioned, the behavioral indicator test, the DISC one is a good one. Or it can be done informally. So what I think candidates, people on this phone listening, should realize, even if it's not being done directly, you're being asked to fill out some sort of a profile, it's kind of being evaluated during the discussions. And some of those characteristics that Hank and I talked about earlier, there is kind of a soft assessment along the way because you're interacting with a lot of people. So you could argue maybe that's cultural fit. You could argue the behavioral indicators around work ethic, self-starting, has that person faced challenges and have they dealt with challenges? Those are some of the things that could be soft indicators that talk about behavioral fit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this is a great lead-in to our next section, which is indeed about the behavioral or fit interview. So maybe we can move on to that. We have about 20 minutes left. So let me play back some things that I've heard and seen in my career and then also by people who are doing this. And indeed, I think both of you touched on pretty much what I'm going to hear so quickly. Basically, there are a number of buckets that we look at. The teamwork aspect, which both of you mentioned, the commitment to excellence. One thing that you've touched on but haven't actually quite phrased like this is, but we are in, as Hank said, you know, you have to be able to tell a CEO what you think, and it has to obviously be grounded and intelligent and thought through, but we have to be able to influence and persuade, and that is probably one of the most important skill sets, and we have to be nice about it and so forth, but we really have to be able to get buy-in to certain things. Leadership is important, obviously the problem-solving aspect we've talked about quite a bit, and the communication. And on the right-hand side, you'll see typical questions. Everybody, by the way, on this call will receive a copy of this presentation, so you can look at it. But this is just a way to get some of the discussion going. Some of the things that interviewers look for is that you understand key messages, how you address things with the audience, what the audience needs, how you structure how you encourage inquiry. I think we've both, all three of us have talked about how important it is to listen. That's one of the most undervalued skill sets. And I'm asking the team to move the chart. And that we also look to how you present things when you're difficult to understand, that you don't really show the clarity and the purpose of what you're talking about, too many words, inappropriate jargon, and so forth. So the communication part of this interview is very, very important. Finally, in this final page before I turn it over to Carl and to Hank, there are helpful tips for answering. Make sure that when you answer, you take some time. It is a great sense. It shows a sense that you're confident, that you have poise, and that you're not just running on and running on top of a question, that you actually step back for a second. Focus on how, the what, the why, and the who. That just helps you further make sure you're touching on the points. One thing, regardless of what any kind of an interview you do, whether for Consulting Square, never be negative or complain about a situation or a job you had. And again, always think about the best possible way of doing things, and also think about the time element going backwards and forward, and commensurate with that, make sure your story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And with that, I'll hand that over to Carl and Hank for your responses in terms of how we see behavioral and fit interviews.
Sure, and I'm going to go back two slides to the typical kinds of questions that are asked. And Hank and I have touched upon a lot of this already, but if you were looking kind of for a cheat sheet as you prepare for an interview, the folks that are listening on this call, I would absolutely revisit these questions that are here. I think these are very typical of questions that are asked that deal with teamwork, achieving excellence, the influencing and persuasion. Hank mentioned that several times. Showing leadership, solving problems, and managing communications. I would say that's a very good representation of kind of the categories that are probed on or inquired upon during the behavioral interviewing phase. Hank, do you have additional thoughts on that cluster of questions there, those category of questions?
I think, Carl, four things that I would say that we try to look at. One of the things on this list says inappropriate jargon, and we had an interesting situation very recently where we were hiring somebody for a specific need. They had a master's degree in the need that we were looking for. They had very relevant job experience in it. They had, you know, just a lot of positive qualities, and it was a young lady, very, very credible in her field, but we couldn't force ourselves to hire her because literally the whole interview, everybody she talked with, she talked like a Valley Girl from California, if you remember that, the Valley Girls of 20 years ago. I never heard anything like that in a business setting. It was literally mind-boggling, and she did it repeatedly. And so when we all pooled our thoughts at the end of the process, everybody said, she's perfect on paper and in every way, but we could never put her in front of our clients because she can't communicate without using inappropriate jargon. And I don't know that happens that often, but you really do have to be careful how you express yourself. And I think especially MBAs, when we hire, you know, almost all MBAs, and one of the things that an MBA program can potentially do is hammer so hard on the quantitative skills. And I've seen this more since I was in school, you know, used to be a little bit more balanced, but most MBA programs now are so quantitative that a lot of the folks that we hire, you know, they can do spreadsheets upside down and sideways, but they can't express themselves well, either in writing or verbally. And I think one way to get over that is to read a lot. Reading is very important if you're ever going to be good at writing. And I think, you know, if you get so immersed in quantitative that you don't know how to handle the qualitative, it will not fit with us because we have to have a balance of the two. We also try to take a look at whether somebody's very active. This gets back to the behavior, but one core element of behavior is the tendency to be active versus the tendency to be passive. And that's a very important behavioral dividing line in our organization. We also look for and try to ask questions around figuring out whether somebody tends to be a taker. You know, are all their questions and are all their interests about what they're going to take versus what they're going to give? And we want people that are more oriented toward, you know, what they're going to give in their career versus what they're going to take. So those are just four things that jump out to me in terms of things that we would be probing into.
That's well said. And again, I encourage people to continue as you get these hard copy slides, the slide that's up right now, typical kinds of questions. Be prepared to answer those. Hank, a question that's come in that I think you and I can comment on are, what kind of technical skills, aside from verbal and written communication skills, are you looking for, especially in undergrad hires? And I could start and then you can pile on. So I mentioned, for example, supply chain is one of our competencies. Well, we're hiring people with engineering backgrounds to work in our supply chain practice. Finance is another one of our fastest-growing competencies within the market. So typically we're hiring people with finance and or accounting degrees, and I consider that to be technical. We do an awful lot of work in IT security that is red hot in the market. So people that have an IT kind of background, in particular with IT security woven in there or risk management woven in there, that we pay a lot of attention to. We also do a lot of work in the area of ERP solutions, mobile technologies, cloud computing. So we're looking for people that have the technical educational background and in some cases, depending upon the level we're bringing them in at, the experiences along those lines. Hank, are there other, when you think either your firm or beyond your firm, of other technical skills that are sought out after in the market?
Well, if we're talking about undergrads, there would be a fairly limited number of undergrad positions that we would bring in. But I would say that, you know, very similar to yours, Carl, the one I would underscore would be finance. We have been able to find certain undergrads who either were interns or came in as analysts in the investment banking side of our business, where their financial skills are just, you know, outstanding, and they can make a lot of contribution very quickly because of that.
Yep, I would agree. I think in the interest of time, because I know we have 10 minutes left, I think we've pretty much covered the behavioral bits. John?
Yeah. So why don't we go on to the case interview, since actually we're starting to trend towards that, since the case interview is actually prime or usually used the more technical side of a person's background and abilities. One thing I just want to say also about the behavioral fit, whenever I talk to students, I should never pay attention to how they're dressed while they're listening to me, because they usually come from class. But we can never forget also the personal appearance aspect of an interview. Just wanted to throw that in. It should go without saying, but clearly, clean, proper suit with a tie is always, you know, best default position. Shine shoes, you know, stand up straight, look a person in the eye. We didn't address it, but let's never forget that these are professional interviews and you need to present yourself as a professional. Now in the workforce, other things happen and we have, you know, Fridays usually you don't have to wear a suit, wonderful things like, but let's not forget part as well. So moving on to the case interviews. There are really two kinds of case interviews, and I know, Carl, you have something to say about this. And traditionally, both can be used in a variety of formats, sometimes even in the fit interview. There's these sizing or estimation ones, how many telephone boxes are in London or how many people wear earrings in New York City. It's basically to see how quickly you can come up with an answer that makes some sort of logical sense. Then there's the real business case, and this is obviously much more what people think of in a case interview. You can ask questions, where should we launch our new product? Should one company buy another company? How much should you pay for the rights of the World Cup in this example? And there you're given bits and pieces of information. Sometimes the information's left out to see how you deal with incomplete data. But usually you have enough so you can begin systematically working through it and coming out with an answer. And we'll come to that in a second. And most firms have assessment sheets that they use, sometimes highly developed and very quantitative, if we go to the next page, yes. And that can really four things. Problem solving, again, this communication aspect. Obviously, analysis, technical insight, this is where we're really going to be able to test that. And then the interpersonal, because eventually you're going to have to present the results of your case, and you may get pushback. You may be put into situations that you're uncomfortable with. So they want to see how mature you are and how tactful you can be presenting it. A couple of helpful hints, and then we'll move over to our to Hank and to Carl. Very often you are going to present, so you should structure this well. Think of diagrams you want to use. There are many frameworks. Porter 5 Force is the obvious one that everybody thinks of, but there are many others. Always think about what have you forgotten. Is there something that you need to think about that you haven't thought of? So what else is there? Obviously, we said this a few times, listening is very careful, especially if the presentation or the case is presented to you orally or there's a chance for question and answers before you start solving it. Listen to what's being said or what questions are being asked. And again, when you present, don't be afraid of silence. If you present a point and suddenly people are looking at you and they don't say anything, it's not a bad thing. They could also be testing how well you deal with it among silence, because you will get that in your professional life. So with that, why don't I hand this again over to Carl and to Hank for some reactions, some filling in the holes here.
Yeah, I think if you reflect back on the continuum that John and Hank and we discussed earlier, the case interview is towards the end. It's the list of candidates has been narrowed down, so the filters begin to tighten. So the case interview really becomes an opportunity for the individual, at least at Ernst & Young. We've moved all of ours to real-world situations. We'll actually give them, made-up company name that's struggling with either revenue growth, bottom line, performance, something that is material to what we do for a living. And we'll give them some time to just read it and think about it. And then they have to engage with the interviewer, or in some cases interviewers, and basically respond back with how would they go about trying to help that client understand and solve the problem that they're trying to deal with. Very real world. These are real business issues. And what we're looking for is how does the candidate organize their thinking to kind of break down the business issue? If it's random, that's not a good thing. If it's organized in some analytical and thoughtful way on trying to solving the problem. And then also, that's very helpful, and also how they're presenting it back out to the interviewer. I've had candidates come in and they kind of just skip all around in the interview, and they're just sharing sound bites, and there really is no conclusion as to what they would have done except a lot of aha insights. Well, bottom line is consultants get paid to solve problems and to make recommendations. And if you can't get to a recommendation that has a logic pattern behind it, that person is not going to fare very well within the case interview. I know many of the universities these days have practice sessions around doing case interviews. I would encourage everybody on this call to go through some practice sessions. It's not something you can just make up and go on the fly in an interview if you've never been exposed to case-based interviewing or case-based problem solving. Hank, additional thoughts on, be it for your firm or be it the broader consulting agenda on the whole case interviewing process?
Only one thing I would add, Carl, from a consultative skill standpoint, I think there's part of this on the analysis where it talks about ask the right questions and focus on the important issues, and I think you talked about organization. We sometimes talk about the ability to frame issues for clients.
Well and said.
We have a lot of clients who one of the reasons they're struggling with the problem is it's the forest for the trees syndrome. Mm. They're so close to the problem that they haven't actually been able to step back and frame it in a way that makes sense. And somebody from the outside can be worth their weight in gold simply by doing that. So that can be an important part of the case, I believe.
That's profound. I mean, what Hank just said about framing the issue, You can look at certain techniques like the Minto principle, the situation, complication, and then the resolution. There's other techniques that actually sort of frame it out so that it gives it appropriate context towards action. Those are very powerful. But and one of the questions, a couple of questions that have come in, is how do you prepare for the case interviews? I think we did cover off on that. Is one is get with your counselor at the university, get with others in the university, and do some practice scenarios is the bottom line as how you really do prepare. It's not something you can just read a book on. It's something you really have to do a little bit of practice in some sort of a group setting. And I'm almost positive every university offers something along these lines because most firms, that's how they interview these days. Case-based.
I think most businesses teach that way.
And to hinge on that, the statistic I've been given is that to ensure success in the case interview, a student probably needs to do 50 to 60 cases in some sort of a preparatory system, either with friends or as part of a class or a seminar. Sounds a little extreme to me, but that is a statistic that's been offered to me several times.
So we're getting back to the music theme of practice to get the
practice. Exactly. So finally, let's just, I know we're coming up to the hour, and I know Hank and Carl gave us some tips, so if you two would go through your global tips, and we'll end the session. We have a few evaluation questions after this that we'd love to get your feedback on for those of you on the phone. So, Carl and Hank, if you'd like to say your final words.
Sure. You want to go first, Hank?
Sure. I think mine tend to be the ones toward the bottom.
Okay, sure.
So I'll pick up with, I think the ones I put on, research the company thoroughly. It has been surprising to me over the years to have people show up to our firm for an interview and really not have a handle on exactly what we do and who we do it for and, you know, some pretty basic, it's a very rudimentary comment, but, you know, really knowing that company inside and out is important. We're looking for people that have a lot of personality, a lot of spark, people that you want to go to dinner with, people that you want to go to a party with. I mean, this is a fun business. It's a social business, and I promise you that in the C-suite, most CEOs want to be around people that they like, and so there are people that are engaging, people that have confidence and don't mind interfacing at that level. You know, it's probably not a business for shy people would be another way to say that. We want people who ask a lot of questions. You know, I've had interviews where I said, any questions? And they said, well, I've already asked it of everybody else. And that's a really bad answer because you want, even if you've asked the same question for 10 other people, you should ask the 11th just to see if you get the same answer. And people that are aggressive questioners, I think, is important to us. Staying away from extremism in how you present answers is important. You know, it's another way of saying don't be too heavy-handed or too judgmental. Carl made the point earlier that most management and most consulting stays in shades of gray, and the best answers are, you know, typically are in the gray. So somebody that tends to be too black and white, too dogmatic, is probably something that I would discourage. And of course, communication, which we've I think said so many times, but it's a critical aspect.
Yep. Yeah, and to add to that, you mentioned about research the company. That gets to know your target. And nowadays, in today's internet environment, research press clippings, review the corporate website, really use the technology that's out there to really understand the company that you're interviewing with. It's a respect issue. It's a respect issue. The be relevant part is really try to connect your experiences, be it work, be it the school, volunteer activities, anything that you've got that's happened in your life, connect it to the interviewing type questions. So do not just pull from the academic part of your experiences, pull from any work experiences and or social activities that you may have facilitated or community activities that you may have facilitated. Be concise. The interviewer has a set of questions they want to get through. So if you pontificate for a long period of time on one particular question, it's probably going to end up frustrating the interviewer. So make sure you get to your point crisply and then allow the interviewer to pull you down to the next level of detail. The network, I think, is very important. Connect with classmates that are already working for the company that you're interested in. They can help refer you in. That carries a lot of weight, referrals from existing employees. They can also give you a sense of what the firm is all about, what the company is all about. And the networking also can help position you for opportunities within the firm. It's a very competitive market out there in recruiting talent. I don't care if it's a small firm or a big firm that's recruiting talent. There are a lot of folks in the market looking for jobs. So you really do need to pay attention to these tips that we've shared throughout this discussion today to better position yourself would be my final bit of advice. There's a lot of wealth of information that has been communicated to you guys today.
And thank you very much, Carl and Hank. I would just, as my final comment said about the networking, for those of you at schools who feel that you don't have quite the resources available to you to get in front of consulting firms, to learn about them, this last point, network is absolutely key. The alumni network has, for many small schools, and I hear this around the country and in other parts of the world, that if you can work the alumni network, invariably you will find senior partners at many, many very big branded firms and smaller firms who are eager to help you get into the industry if, again, you're well prepared and committed to it. At some of the smallest schools that I've talked to or some of the schools that are just not that much on the radar screen. So I just can only emphasize networking is very, very key. But again, thank you very much, Hank and Carl, and I'd ask Nori now to move to the evaluation questions. We'll stay on each question for about 30 seconds to a minute to allow you to make your answers. We obviously will not show the answers. This is for us internally to have a better sense of how we delivered this webinar and what we can do better in the future. And again, many thanks, Hank and Carl.
Thanks,
sure,
John. Nice to work with you all. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye. Okay, perhaps we can move to the next one. Thank you. Okay, perhaps we can move to the next one. Thank you. Okay, next one, please. And again, here we're just looking for short sentences. For the least effective elements. Great. Well, thank you very much, everybody who was on this webinar, in particular those who took the time to fill out the evaluation form. Please, we have you all in our database, so keep your eyes open for the next webinars. We probably will not be doing anything until early next year, but then we will have regularly every month a webinar to help you through the recruitment process, making decisions about the firm you want to either intern at or take a job at, and then how to prepare yourself for your first time in consulting. So thank you again, everybody, and we look forward to seeing you at future webinars. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Please stand by.